This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Jocklick in Salt Lake City, Utah on January 22nd, 1994. And we were talking about Outokumpu.
Outokumpu, yeah, you know, the state-owned Finnish company. Now, I believe they're no longer wholly state-owned, but they were after the war. They're an old-line mining company of relatively modest base metal and nickel operations in Finland, and for some reason that I still don't fully understand, they have come up with the bulk of the, if you like, breakthroughs in mineral processing, concentrating and smelting technology since the war. And I had the pleasure of visiting their operations about 18 months ago. Pam was with me on that trip. And we went to their headquarters at Espoo, just outside of Helsinki. And then we went up to the Harjavalta smelter and across to the research facilities at Pori. And it was, you know, this was in May, and it was still pretty chilly, although the days were long. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's that climate that stimulates the brains of these people to come up with solutions to problems that no one else in the world seems to be capable of. They are, as you know, very friendly people, very, I might say, staid in some ways. They like a drop to drink every now and then, and have a good sense of humor. But they certainly get the job done, and they've done wonders for the mining industry with their technological derring do. The smelter is due for completion in 95, and I believe it's on track. And that will complete the modernization of Utah Copper. But wait, there is still the tailings pond. And I have a hunch, you know, in my observation of mining, complex mining operations over the years, there never is an end to requirements for money to be spent. I can only talk about what I've observed in the last decade or two at Kennecott. Before I comment on that, let me just give a brief account of something that was very closely interwoven with the study of alternatives for the smelter and then the construction of the smelter itself. And that is environmental negotiations with the EPA beginning in 1990. Are we on?
Yes, yes.
What happened was that several sites on Kennecott's Utah Copper property began to attract the attention of the EPA in the early 80s, and they designated some of these as CERCLIS sites. CERCLIS is an EPA database of about 25,000 sites nationwide which are potential candidates for putting on the national priority list, otherwise known as the Superfund list. And these were old tailings and waste rock along the eastern flank of the Okres, dating from probably before the turn of the century and having absolutely nothing to do with Kennecott's copper operations. And of course, that's all Kennecott has ever mined, copper. Kennecott was never involved in the lead zinc operations that preceded the mining of copper. Sorry, not so much lead zinc, but lead silver, I meant, in the Lark area and elsewhere. There were some questions about surface and groundwater runoff from Bingham Canyon. You know, I, with my geological training, had always looked at the outcrops in Bingham Canyon and felt that just the natural weathering there over years and the Gossan formation would produce acidic runoff containing heavy metals just through natural causing without any disturbance of the ground ever having occurred. Nevertheless, both the state and the EPA said to us in the early 80s that they were concerned about this water contamination. And our response was, well, look, anyone whose water supply seems to be prejudiced in any way will be happy to replace their domestic water. And we ran pipelines in there and did that with a number of households. Not that the level of contamination were high enough to cause any health problems, but they exceeded standards promulgated by the EPA. We agreed with the state that we would carry out a study of this plume of contaminated water and would devise ways and means of arresting it to the extent that was required. Remediation is another subject because we had found that with the lime-rich terrain in that area, all you needed was for that water to percolate through the limey sediments for a period of time and the whatever metals were contained were precipitated out anyway. Just a matter of time. Well, this five-year study ended about 1988, and by then seven of these sites were in the CERCLIS database. In 1990, the EPA finalized a new hazard ranking system to determine what sites should be put on the National Priorities List, and the way this system worked increased the chances that a site that had made the CERCLIS list would indeed get on the Superfund list. So we made contact with Region 8 of EPA in Denver, not that we hadn't been in constant contact with them anyway, working them on other issues. We knew them well. We had been, you know, consulting with them on this PM10 issue, for instance. Rod Davey and I met with Jim Shearer, who was the administrator of EPA, in November of 1990 and got his input on that. And as early as that, we had acquainted him with the possibility that we might consider the construction of a new smelter. And why I did that was that I was extremely concerned that a major investment like that should be made only under conditions when the environmental ground rules were known pretty well. I was apprehensive that a project like that could run into some arbitrary decisions made at a relatively low level in the EPA that could delay or halt halfway the construction of the smelter and cause a financial debacle. So I wanted the EPA to know that we were possibly contemplating that, even though at the same time we were still working on plans to bring the existing smelter into compliance with the PM10 and SO2 regulations, and we did that anyway, mainly through curtailments, production curtailments. You see, the new smelter won't be built in 90, won't be finished till 95. We're talking 1988 here, 7 years before. So we knew that we'd have to keep the old smelter running in compliance with regulations until the new plant was finished.
But you didn't want to switch in the rules during the construction.
Well,
of the new
we
one.
Just didn't know which way the surplus site debate was going to go. It was a new territory to us. Our study showed that that this plume wasn't a particular threat to any habitation, what little habitation existed there, nor was it likely to be in the future. But what we didn't want was someone saying, well, we estimate that the volume of contaminated water is such and such, hundreds of millions of gallons, you've got to remediate this, which A, would be technically impossible, and would bring about a contentious relationship with the EPA. We didn't want to.
This word plume in connection with water is strange to me.
It's commonly used.
Is it? I think of plume as the air. But
you're thinking of a plume in the vertical plane.
Right.
This is a plume in the horizontal plane.
Okay.
La plume de ma tante.
Okay.
Well, we were worried about this new hazard ranking system. And in February of 91, we went to Denver to meet with Jim Shearer and his deputy, Jack McGraw, because we wanted to assure them that whatever the circular sites needed doing, we would do, even though a search for PRPs, potential responsible parties, would probably show that we weren't in any way responsible for this contamination. But we said, we'll do it. It's on our ground now. It's a concern of ours. But we don't want to be listed on Superfund because that would probably magnify the cost of it by a factor several times, uselessly waste public funds, and take much longer. Well, the meeting was a little equivocal. We didn't really get any definitive answers from the EPA officials, and we then explained our problem to the environmental authorities here in Utah and also to Governor Bangerter, and they I don't know whether they spoke to Region 8 or whatever. The upshot of it was that any EPA listing was deferred for 6 months anyway, gave us breathing space, and we want to work with a will with the also with the aid of a very capable consultant in Denver, Adrian Brown, who happened to be an Australian, but we didn't hold that against them. And to analyze these sites and come up with preliminary plans for remediation, for removal and or remediation.
This is all seven sites?
The seven sites, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we went beyond that. We studied the whole of our property and determined what other sites had any contamination at all, even though they posed no threat whatsoever to human health by virtue of their location and by virtue of the very low level of contamination, and added those to the seven that had already been listed by the EPA and devised, with the aid of Adrian Brown and his people, plans for remediation. It was still very difficult to talk to the EPA in terms of a voluntary cleanup effort, which we were interested in the summer of 1988. The EPA had identified lead and arsenic bearing tailings in the downstream reaches of Bingham Creek, where the creek went through presidential areas. Again, not done by Kennecott, not caused by Kennecott or any predecessor of Kennecott, but evidently caused by the lead silver miners of the last century. And possibly by the operations of Anaconda, who were involved in that, and their predecessors. The EPA, with our encouragement, carried out a blood level test of kids in these residential areas and didn't find any elevated levels. But we said to the EPA, look, if you're really concerned about this, and we are too, because we're part of this community and we don't want to have any panic here or anything about the danger of lead poisoning to the kids, why don't we do a joint effort to excavate these tailings? And we're not talking about very large volumes, but you had to go into people's backyards and do this, and remove this material to a segregated site on Kennecott property, way up in the foothills of the Orcas there. The EPA agreed to this, and they took responsibility for going in people's backyards and digging this stuff out. And we took responsibility for transporting it, putting it up in the hills. We felt that the Anaconda people, or ARCA as they were, should pay for it, really. We've had trouble collecting from them. I'm not sure whether anything's been collected to date, and the EPA wasn't very effective in pressuring them into making payments. But what that did was establish a bond between us and the EPA. They saw us in action as responsible citizens, and it also caused a lot of favorable comment in the community here as a whole. However, what the EPA had not found was a ways and means in their strictly regulated form to devise a voluntary cleanup agreement with us for the cleanup of these other surplus sites, and the ones they'd identified, and the additional sites that we had identified, which made a total of 18 or 19 sites. Which were in the nature of old abandoned waste rock and tailings, smelting and refining wastes, surface soils, and groundwater. I went to Washington, and David and Litvin and I went to visit the EPA people there, particularly Don Clay, who's the assistant administrator responsible for Superfund, and his lieutenant, Richard Guymond. We had a session with White House counsel, Boyden Gray, with David Gibbons of OMB. And explained to them the essence of our brief, which was that we were volunteering to clean up these sites, even though we hadn't been identified as PRPs, to CERCLA standards, that this would obviate the use of public funds, Superfund monies, that it would be done more efficiently by Kennecott probably than by some contractor selected by EPA, because they weren't in any shape to do it themselves, and would be done more quickly and therefore remove any perceived health threat to anyone. I mean, we had a real positive story to tell here that was a win-win situation for everybody concerned, the people, the EPA, and for Kennecott, because we didn't want the stigma of being listed on Superfund. We didn't want to spend the next 20 or 30 years hassling over remediation alternatives, and we didn't want our, in essence, in practical terms, our customers to feel that they were buying copper from a Superfund site. These are all very practical considerations, business considerations. Well, about that time, President Bush was in Salt Lake, happened to be in Salt Lake City. I had met him before a couple of times when he was still vice president, and I took the opportunity of explaining this problem to him, and he was listened carefully, thought we had a good case, and I understand did speak to the appropriate administration officials afterwards about it, expressing himself in favor of a voluntary agreement, provided that everybody could be convinced that we were going to act responsibly, and that was our job to convince everybody accordingly. Well, I was concerned with the interaction of this effort with the planning of the smelter and refinery project. I went to the assistant administrator for air quality in Washington, Bill Rosenberg, and expressed our concern to him that, you know, to start committing to a major investment like that when our voluntary cleanup proposal was still being debated caused some unease to me. As I said before, the RTZ board approved the project in 91, but also expressed concern on this issue, naturally. Well, in November of 91, we received a letter from Region 8 with a proposal for a consent decree, which appeared pretty draconian to us at the time, particularly in terms of its very limited judicial recourse that we would have and the penalties that we would incur if we were perceived to be not in compliance with the consent decree. But nevertheless, it had the elements of putting the ball in our court, where we would have the responsibility for identifying the sites and for proposing the removal and remedial actions. In other words, we would be carrying the ball as managers and technically, rather than having the EPA do that.
Now, this was still, this was only water.
No, as I said, it was these other, some were abandoned waste rock and tailings, active tailings.
Right, but it was the water contamination.
No, it was the contamination of these entities that I've enumerated. I mentioned we had 20 surface sites.
But the danger was because of contaminated water?
No. Contaminated soil and contaminated surface and underground water.
Okay.
See, the wastes were not... The waste rock and the tailings, the old waste rock and tailings were separate entities that had contamination in the solid state, not in the liquid state.
Your smelter concern, of course, was air, so you were dealing with the whole separately, but...
Yeah, the two were interwoven because, you know, a couple of these sites were identified were close to the old smelter, mm-hmm. To the existing smelter. And I mean, in my... I don't get nightmares, but I mean, if I'd had a nightmare, it would have been perhaps that we build a new smelter on the site that was afterwards found to be, the soil was found to be contaminated retroactively, and someone would say, pull down a new smelter and clean up the soil, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well.
So this consent decree proposal came and. No,
yeah, well, I mean, it came, and it came, however, with the caveat that this was just a first shot and that it should be the beginning of the negotiation towards a final document. And let me say one thing. You know, the EPA people had tended to be characterized by some elements of the mining industry of being unfeeling and not very intelligent people and so on and so forth. I got to know EPA in Region 8 very well, and I got to know the EPA people in Washington. I can tell you they were no different than a cross-section of a major public utility or academic institution or whatever. They had some very bright people, some not so bright, some people of goodwill, some very vindictive people, and I became friendly with quite a few of them. Others I learned to handle with kid gloves. It was an exercise in human relations, and the more it went on, the more I learned, the more I became convinced that we could work together. What began to concern me, though, when we received this letter from the EPA, this preliminary letter, what began to concern me was that legalistic issues might begin to overshadow the business and technical considerations of the matter. And there... was a legal counsel in Region 8, Matt Cohen, who's supposed to be a contact man for our lawyers in drafting this consent decree, and I'll say quite frankly, had considerable difficulty with him, which weren't directly related to his legal expertise, or lack thereof, depending on one's view. And this didn't improve with the passage of time. Nevertheless, we did manage to reach an agreement in principle, which ran to about 7 or 8 pages, by early 1992, by March of 92. And the parties to this agreement were the Department of Environmental Quality of the state of Utah. These were reasonable people with whom we could, reach an understanding without too much difficulty. The EPA and Kennecott. Well, the essence of this agreement in principle was, and it said so, the EPA and the Department of Environmental Quality will commence a CERCLA enforcement pilot project under which consideration of proposed listing of Kennecott sites on the NPL will be delayed so long as Kennecott is in full compliance with all the requirements of the consent decree. That was the essence of it, and that was okay. Now, as I say, a person coming in cold would look at that consent decree and say, my God, this is terribly one-sided. This is a person who still had his mindset in pre-1970 days, before the Environmental Protection Act was promulgated and before the pendulum started to swing very heavily in favor of environmental control and against industry. And for many years, people thought, well, the pendulum's going to start swinging back. And it was my view very early on, no, sir. The midpoint or the fulcrum about which this pendulum will gravitate will be way off to one side, and that fulcrum is going to continue to shift. This agreement in principle was agreed to by the parties, and before signing, I went to London and sat with Bob Wilson and his men. They thought it was pretty tough. This wasn't the first time we had discussed it with other discussions before. The point of view of the EPA was regarded as pretty extreme in London. There were some people there who opposed making a voluntary agreement at all. But Bob Wilson at that time saw the merit of proceeding with this, and the executive committee there agreed we should go ahead. That was great. Would have been great if within 12 hours of that meeting, and I was still in London, a list of changes, request for changes, arrived from the EPA. Mm. I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw it. The EPA people said apologetically, we had to get Justice Department approval, and this is the input from Justice. And we said, gentlemen, you had led us to believe that this had already been cleared with all the agencies. How could you do this to us? Mm. And all I can say is it caused, understandably, a terrible impression in London, and from that day on, I never succeeded in convincing the people over there that the EPA was acting in good faith. Mm-hmm. And from then on, our discussions became very contentious, not just with the EPA, but with the people in London, who were understandably upset by this mm-hmm. modus operandi. I said, look, you're dealing with a government agency there, the EPA. They are capable of bungling just the same as any other government agency. They didn't really mean to upset anyone by acting in this way, but the damage had been done because not everybody in London had been aboard with acceding to the original version.
They thought
of
you ought to wait
EPA
until
agreement.
You were forced into everything.
Beg your pardon?
They thought you should wait until you were forced to do something.
Well, those people were imposed. They thought, mm-hmm. well, get listed and do it according to the old Superfund system. Mm-hmm. But they did not understand the business implications and mm-hmm. didn't take those into account. Namely, that it would probably cost us a lot more money, that it would take longer, that would give us a bad image in the in the community and with our customers, mm-hmm. of course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea was, nevertheless, we negotiated these changes, and the people in London agreed to signing off on that. However, a cover letter was attached, signed by me, which expressed some of our apprehensions mm-hmm. about the process and procedures to date. And the idea was that then, as quickly as possible, we would proceed with the negotiation of a definitive agreement, and this would be promulgated as soon as possible. Now, we are talking here by then April of 92, and as we know, elections in the United States were due in November. And the theory was that we would get this agreement done under the then current administration. Not that we had any reason to believe that any administration of any color wouldn't find this a good deal for the people of the United States and for the EPA. In April of 92, the press got wind of the agreement in principle. It was publicized in the papers. It got favorable comment, by and large, also from the environmental community, because we emphasize the voluntary nature of this effort. Well, negotiations did proceed. I worked very closely with Region 8. By then, we had established that this was a matter for headquarters too, because new ground was being broken with such a voluntary agreement. So EPA Region 8 was perfectly attuned to the fact that headquarters there was being involved too. And in fact, we realized it was in both our interests to have the headquarters currently informed and on side, rather than presenting them with a fait accompli down the road mm-hmm. and having them throw up their hands in horror and say, well, this is all news to us. We announced the smelter project in March of 92. We had announced that just before the agreement in principle was finalized. There were some people who suggested we should hold up even engineering with the smelter project until we had resolved the consent decree, but we felt that would be counterproductive, and so we were proceeding on parallel tracks with both of these endeavors. I made frequent trips to Washington and to Denver for conferences. Bobby Cooper, who not so long before that had been mine manager of a little Ridgeway gold company, and whom I had subsequently promoted in fairly short order to general manager there, and then to manager of U.S. mines other than the copper operations, and who had spent, I believe, 12 months in London on secondment to EPA, to RTZ, had returned from London, and I put him to work as being our chief negotiator with the EPA for the consent decree. And he had very capable help from Lee Caldwell. She had had some EPA experience herself. And from Preston Chiaro, very capable young man whom we had hired as Director of Environmental Affairs. And Preston is now Vice President of Environmental Affairs. So that was a capable team. They made progress, but more and more they got hung up on legal technicalities. Dennis Connell, Engineering Vice President of Construction, had no problem seeing eye to eye with DEQ and the EPA technical experts on what needed to be done. And in fact, we were proceeding at flank speed on cleanup of some of the surplus sites. In 1992, I believe we spent $40 million and a similar amount in 93, simply going ahead with those sites that were amenable to fairly obvious, simply removal actions. Mm-hmm. And that in itself should have again convinced the EPA, and did convince them, of our good faith. But what was holding it up was differences in legal interpretation between EPA counsel, our legal counsel, and RTZ, who'd gotten skittish as a result of this, what they saw as reneging on the agreement in principle, had inserted their general counsel, who had a very negative view of the whole voluntary cleanup proposal. So we got into a kind of a three-cornered debate here, which dragged on through 92 until one began to consider very seriously that this agreement might not be consummated before the end of the year, even though the EPA themselves were hailing it as potentially a major breakthrough, because, believe you me, CERCLA had very few friends anywhere in the country because of the 1,000-odd CERCLA sites. Very few of them were proceeding anywhere near final cleanup, and it was well recognized that the bulk of the public money being spent was being spent in litigation, so-called transaction costs, rather than on cleaning up contamination in the ground. It had a really bad, bad image, and this seemed to be one way of considerably improving that image. Towards the end of the year, the pressure was turned up on trying to reach an agreement. We had help from the Utah congressional delegation, particularly Senators Hatch and Garn were involved. Senator Garn was not running again for re-election, so he felt very free to express his point of view in his inevitably impressive way. The EPA Administrator Bill Riley, who certainly had never been regarded particularly as a friend of industry, he saw the merits of this proposal, and he instructed his staff to reach an agreement by the end of the year. But cut a long story short, despite the rather intensive action. At the end of the year, the agreement was not consummated. It was hung up on, ironically enough, guarantees that Kennecott and RTZ would have the financial capability to perform the cleanup. Now, isn't that ridiculous? Well, we were spending money on that rate. RTZ Group, the largest or second largest mining group in the world. I don't know whether Anglo or RTZ is the biggest one. Agreement couldn't be reached on financial guarantees. On the plume I've talked about out of Bingham Canyon, we wanted a safeguard that someone wasn't going to say, now remediate the plume overnight, more or less, which is like pumping out the Great Salt Lake or King Canute controlling the oceans and stick us with some unconscionable bill. Mm-hmm. So the EPA said, well, we'll do a what they called a focused feasibility study, which meant a feasibility study with a narrow focus, which would identify certain remediation methods and presumably discard the ones that were obviously impracticable. But they couldn't commit to doing this by year end, and all we wanted was that the consent decree would be conditional, our signing the consent decree would be conditional on us having some input into this focused feasibility study when it might be completed early in 1993. And again, the EPA couldn't see its way clear to giving us a voice in it. So on these two issues, the whole thing founded. It was not, it wasn't done. We had been to London with our team. We had won the day there in reaching agreement that the rest of the consent decree was acceptable, and just for these two sticking points that we came back with, the EPA was not prepared to sign off on. Well, the rest is history, I'm sad to say, because with the change of administration in government in Washington, with Carol Browner coming in and replacing Bill Riley, she made herself totally unavailable during the first months of 1993, which at first one could understand, but as it dragged on month after month, was more difficult to understand. And we didn't know really what the future held. There was no mechanism for resuming and trying to negotiations and trying to finalize the consent decree. And when my watch expired in June 93, everything was in limbo. I was very apprehensive that some lower level person in EPA might forward the listing in his next listing package, include the Kennecott property, forward it to the OMB, and once it went there, historically it was very hard to make any modifications. I was worried that this might happen. Region 8, no new administrator had been appointed, so they were in limbo. No one was willing to make any decisions or say anything. So it was in limbo when I left. I don't know in detail, nor would it be appropriate for me to comment on what happened after my departure, whether the effort by Kennecott to finalize this agreement was continued with sufficient intensity to have any hope of it succeeding. All I can say is that in the papers last week was statement that listing of the property was likely to proceed, I have made no bones all along that I regard this as a extremely serious matter, and as a tragedy for Kennecott, if it does indeed happen, as from the newspaper accounts seems quite likely.
You had mentioned that Bob Cooper was involved on the. He was your chief negotiator, and he's the one who succeeded you?
Yes, he subsequently became, I believe in September of 93, became chief operating officer,
mm-hmm.
and he succeeded me. And I said before, what we had been through over the years and so on, we had several people who were qualified, and he was the one who was picked to succeed me.
So he was acquainted with this situation anyway?
Very much so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you had mentioned in a conversation that we had a few months ago, Judge Green.
Oh yeah, Tom Green, yeah.
How there was a connection with this CERCLA.
None.
I see. I thought that he was involved in that.
No, he was concerned with a separate issue. The state made a natural resource damage claim in connection with that plume, and got us going on that study those years ago. And he was for a period involved with that, but he was not involved in the Superfund issue, which I've been talking about.
This has not ever gotten to a court situation.
Well, it hasn't. No, because the agreement hasn't been promulgated, but
mm-hmm.
the involvement of lawyers, of course, has been prolific. And in my view, it was a mistake on the part of all concerned to let the lawyers take it over and make it a legal hassle instead of letting the overall community, environmental, and business benefits of the voluntary cleanup agreement overshadow the legal squabbling. My counterparts in EPA management were totally also of my point of view, but did not in the bureaucracy have the ability to channel the energies of the lawyer in a way that an agreement could be reached.
Shudder to think of the expense.
Oh.
Could have cleaned up all the super funds for.
And if listing should occur, this is just the tiniest tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Over the next decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy for me to be eloquent on this because during the last couple of years of my watch at Kennecott, a considerable proportion of my time went into this attempt
mm-hmm.
to have the voluntary cleanup agreement finalized and avoid the Superfund listing, and
mm-hmm.
as of June of last year, I had every reason to believe that my efforts would not have been in vain.
Mm-hmm.
I regarded that as one of the most important things that I had done at Kennecott. I don't think it was viewed that way necessarily in London, but at a distance that far across the Atlantic, I don't think they quite had the feel of the gravity of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must hurt because it's so, in a sense, unproductive, although of course it's productive too, but when you think of the time and expense that goes into something like this instead of just getting the job done.
Well, as you know, CERCLA is now up for reauthorization.
Mm.
Earlier this year, I was up before a panel of Western senators of both Republican and Democratic persuasion, and related to them a little bit of my experience over the previous 2 years. They understood perfectly, and believe you me, the Democrats were totally in accord with the Republicans that the Superfund process had to be drastically revised to be effective and not continue to be a drain on and a waste of public funds.
Right.
Well, that's allied to the smelter. The smelter project is going forward full blast, but from where I sit, and not that I have any involvement in it, but I would, in my thinking about it, feel a lot more comfortable if that consent decree had been finalized. I would feel a lot more comfortable about that major investment. We still have a few minutes to
turn that up. Okie doke.
When the smelter and refinery project is completed, Kennecott's investment in the modernization of Bingham Canyon will have amounted to $1.5 billion. You take $700 million into the mine and the concentrator, and almost nine hundred million into the smelter and refinery, and you're over $1.5 billion, and that still leaves the tailings pond to be addressed. So we're talking about a total of $2 billion.
Real money.
Yeah, it's real money. And, you know, when you think of what's been accomplished over the years, first by way of the cost reduction without capital investment, and then with the investment of these funds, we should think a little bit about where Bingham Canyon stands today competitively in the world, where it stood back in 1980. In 1980, it was one of the highest cost copper producers in the world. In by 95, it will be not only one of the lowest cost, but also one of the cleanest copper producing operations. Just considering the worker productivity, back in 1980 at Utah Copper, an employee year produced 31 tons of refined copper, and then the cost reductions before the shutdown had raised this to 47 tons, and the further manpower reductions and the improvements during shutdown raised this to 59 tons per man year, and eventually, with the completion of the mine concentrator modernization, we were at 110 tons per man year, 3.5 times the workforce productivity recorded in 1980, and this it will be again produced maybe to 4 times by the time the smelter is produced, by the time the smelter is completed. And the cost reductions have been correspondingly impressive. By 92, the full costs of production were about one-third of the 1980 costs in real terms. Now, the what we call the net costs, which is after crediting the byproducts, the value of the byproducts against the cost of production, these have varied all over the place depending on the level of precious metal prices. Mm-hmm. But when the mine concentrator completion, when the mine concentrator project was completed, we were at a level of 30, 35 cents a pound of copper net. Net cash costs. When I say cash costs, I'm not including depreciation, amortization of capital. Now, that's one thing. If the smelter project had not been undertaken and we were going to have to eventually ship all of our concentrates, then the cash costs would have doubled to over 60 cents a pound, and that would no longer put Kennecott in a very good position, in a good position competitively, because after all, Kennecott wasn't the only one that carried out major cost reductions in the latter part of the 1980s. In fact, the copper industry is often used as an example, the domestic copper industry, as having done a tremendous job of putting its house in order, and despite the relatively low ore grades relative to many other producers around the world, being competitive cost-wise. The lean Kennecott, the lean modus operandi that emerged from our tribulations of the 1980s is something which hopefully is ingrained in Kennecott for the not only presently but for the future. And that's pretty pertinent because, you know, there's a lot of new capacity, production capacity slated to come on, particularly in South America. I'm thinking of newly announced projects like El Abra and Zaldívar. Now, these are going to be very capital intensive, very high capital costs. But once the money's been spent and they're in operation, their cash operating costs are going to be low, are going to be competitive. And it'd take a very severe depression in copper markets to cause them to ever consider curtailing production or to shut down entirely. So to remain competitive in the long-term future, it'll be necessary for Kennecott to produce the lean and frugal way of operating that we instituted during the 1980s.
I don't know if this is a question I should ask or whether you can answer. How many years does it take to pay this off and start making a profit again on an investment of this?
Well,
I mean, is there a rule of thumb
I can't,
try
to
do
I think
10
that's
years, 15 years?
I can't, you know, and I shouldn't really discuss that in detail, but let me just just give you a guide.
Clearly there are
at what discount rate would you find a major domestic mining project to be attractive? What sort of discount rate would you apply? Well, pick a number. What would you say?
10%?
Well, you know, in the good old days, going back 40 years ago, when Frank Millican and the people were using their fingers to calculate returns using the Hoskold, the famous old Hoskold formula. Remember that? That was a went out with the dinosaurs, I guess. But you know, a 10% discounted cash flow rate of return is reasonable, I suppose, because mining is still a risky business, even in a politically stable country such as this, with the change in environmental regulations, with those changes fairly unforeseeable. So okay, let's 10% is reasonable. Well, you can imagine that in, if you like, selling these projects here in order to get the financing, we certainly would not have used a lower discount rate than that. And from this here, then you can roughly calculate how long it would take to get your money back. But it all depends on how valid your assumptions as to future copper prices would be.
Variables.
Yeah, particularly the price factor. And as I said, there's a lot of capacity scarce later to come on stream in the next few years.